welcome to episode 24, really, of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. I'm Jerry Shario, and as usual, I get to introduce to you the guy who is to blame for all of this stuff, Nick Santa Maria.
Is it yes or is it no? Do you love me? Should I stay or should I go? Sorry, but when we, right?
Yes, it sticks in your head.
How did I put it in the book? It is a permanent lodger.
Yes,
in my head, and since I was a child, and it's still my favorite scene in the movie. Yeah. What movie are we talking about? We are talking about Africa Screams. Now I spent all night watching it last night and making notes. What's the matter?
No. What? You're on the wrong continent. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, you am.
Let's try a vowel then. I didn't realize we were playing Wheel of Fortune.
Once we get Vanna White over here, I'll let you. But until then, no, we're talking about Mexican Hayride.
Oh, and Vanna White's matter.
There you go.
No, we're talking about Mexican Hayride. That's right. Okay. There's been so much talk about border control and, you know, the whole thing about illegal aliens and everything that it kind of slipped my mind.
There you go.
I didn't want to cause any political madness during the first 15 minutes of our podcast. But hi and welcome, everybody, to Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. My name is Jerry Shario, and we are talking with Nixon. What?
Yeah, keep going. Keep going. Close enough. Yeah, let's just.
I promised someone. One of our fans asked me to do my Pat Buttram imitation, and I'm thinking I should. Should I do that? Should I start it off? So we get it out of the way.
Do it.
I used to do an imitation of Pat Buttram singing "Your Cheatin' Heart" when I was a comedian on the cruise ships. And they used to request it all the time, actually. And then I'd do it, and they'd request me to stop. Yeah. But I wonder if I could do it. Let me start. Excuse me.
Okay.
Mr. Doug. I can't do it. I'm too raspy. If I were one of the seven dwarves, I'd be raspy. Boy, that's pretty prescient also.
It is, yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Rachel Ziegler, Zoyevman,
yep.
Rachel Bigmouth. Mr. Douglas, I have here a genuine Roman tub. Something like that, along those lines. I can't get my voice to go there. But anyway, speaking of voices going there, how about that Rachel Ziegler, Zoyevman?
Yes. How about her? Yeah.
How to win friends and influence people.
That's just the thing you want to do when you have a big movie about to open, you know.
Yeah,
alienate a large percentage of the population.
And what I'm realizing is, and this is going to be dated, by the way, if you're listening to this in 2029, you'll have to Google all of this. But they spent, with the retakes, about $350 million on the film alone. And that's not including all the press and the advertising and everything else that goes with it. They have to make at least $1 billion at the box office to break even. They made $43 million this weekend. I've got that on me, you know? It's crazy. And then you got this crazy lady, this young lunatic who's spouting off at the mouth with politics. It's just, you know, she's not paving the road with butter.
No.
She's not sliding into success with this. So anyway, that's a good lesson to all of you who are listening, all of you who are looking to get your break. And once you get your break, you know, don't break it. Okay, so enough break dancing. Let's talk about Mexican Hayride.
Yes. Huh?
Yeah. Ow. Ooh, I just found the needle. Okay, so Mexican Hayride, 1948. I compare Mexican Hayride to Shemp Howard.
Okay.
Ask me now.
Gladly. Nick, how in the world is Mexican Hayride compared to Shemp Howard?
Shemp replaced Curly. Mexican Hayride came after Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Get my drift? You get my drift?
It's
a perfectly great movie, Mexican Hayride. It's perfectly wonderful, but it follows the iconic, and the overused word, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And that's the only thing working against it.
Yeah.
And in point of fact, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein was sandwiched between two really good Abbott and Costello movies, mm-hmm. The Noose Hangs High and Mexican Hayride, two of their best, as far as I'm concerned. And I know you like this one too, Mexican Hayride, correct?
Oh, yeah. It's been on my favorite list for a long, long time.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned it before we went on the air.
Yes.
That Matthew Conium brought up the fact that it's not on anyone's top 10 in our list in the back of our book, which I find kind of interesting because it really is a good movie. Mm-hmm. Maybe not a good Abbott and Costello movie, you know, if you're looking for go bore a hole in that wall. But it is an excellent Lou Costello film with nice support by Bud Abbott.
Yes.
Bud Abbott's role could have been played by any number of people that I can think of, which I find kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. He's not in it very much. It's a Lou Costello movie. And as I was watching it last night, all of a sudden I'm thinking, he can carry this movie. He can carry a movie alone. He didn't need anyone.
Yes.
He was, okay, this is something every time we finish a podcast, and we'll get back to this, Jerry, because I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
But before I forget again, in England, during this period, during the 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, straight men were not part of the team.
Oh.
Straight men were hired for the comic. Sid Field, who was compared to Chaplin as the greatest British comedian to come along since Chaplin, hired Jerry Desmond to play his straight man. And they're a team. They're together. They're working. They're doing all their sketches together.
Yeah.
But Jerry is for hire. And that went along with Norman Wisdom and other comedians in England. And if Abbott and Costello were a British comedy team, Bud would have been hired as needed for Lou Costello. And that's what this movie reminded me of. It's like England.
Okay.
So Bud disappears for 15 minutes at a time, whatever. And Lou is working with Fritz Feld and Sid Fields and Luba Molina, you know, and Bud's tied up in a closet, you know. But the thing is, before everyone is up in arms about poor Bud, the movie works, and it's fascinating to watch under those conditions. You know, it's a Lou Costello movie. What do you think, Jer?
Well, I agree with you completely. The fact that Lou carries it so well, I found that looking back on the film, I noticed that Bud was not there a few times, but during the film, I never missed him. It's like Lou played the scene so well with whoever he was working opposite, and it held my attention. It kept me entertained. And then Bud came back in. Oh, well, nice little spark. And then we do something with the two of them together. And then Lou goes off on his own again. You know, it works beautifully. And to the point where, as you said, you know, Lou Costello could carry an entire movie himself. I'm just sorry that the one and only time he tried was 30 Foot Bride of Candy Rock. But anyway.
I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about on the Marx Brother Council page, somebody mentioned Roland Barber, who ghosted Harpo's autobiography, and also Rocky Graziano, somebody up there likes me. Mm-hmm. He ghosted that. And they were saying, what other credits does he have? And I was the only person who wrote The 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock.
Yes.
Matthew backed me up. He said that he talked to Roland's son. And Roland Barber's son said that it was a blip on his father's resume, but he was very proud of it. Mm. And he, the son, became a huge Abbott and Costello fan because of it. So there's some good to come from everything, you know?
True.
So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. So speaking of interesting, there's this movie, it's got a preamble, and I'm sorry if it's a lot, but there's a lot to be said before we get to the actual movie itself, because it's based on a Broadway show, a hit Cole Porter Broadway show, Mexican Hayride. It starred Abbott and Costello's old friend from Streets of Paris, their Broadway show, Bobby Clark, with his drawn-on glasses. And Bobby Clark plays the part that Lou plays in the movie. It's decidedly different. There is no Harry Lambert, Bud Abbott's role, but there is a character played by George Givot, who was usually a Greek comedian, Greek dialect comedian. His catchphrase was, "Well, how you like that?" But in this one, he plays Lombo Campos, a Mexican who teams up with Bobby Clark, and they're crooks. And that's really it. They're selling fake stocks and schemes and this and that. And it turns out that at the end, nobody's forgiven. They are deported to face criminal charges. That's the happy musical. It actually lasted 16 months, 481 performances, a wow. decided hit, even with a hitless Cole Porter score. Poor Cole Porter was going through a real bleak point at this time. He wasn't a real dry period, let's put it that way. And it didn't break until a couple of years later with Kiss Me, Kate. Mm. And then he was back again. And of course, he was dealing with the whole thing with his legs after the falling, the horse fell on him and all this stuff, which is weird. It happened in his apartment. That's the weird part.
those Hollywood parties, you know?
Just, yeah. Okay. No, he needed it. They didn't have calculators back then. So he would say, you know, hey, Dobbin, how much is 3 + 4? And he'd hit them, you know, with his hoof. But that was an early form of calculator. Mr. Douglas, Roman tub. Oh, Mr. Haney. So Universal.
Yes.
Pays attention and says, oh boy, there's a hit show with Bobby Clark, and he's a comedian, and we have some comedians under contract, so that works. So what did they do? They dipped into their Universal pockets and pulled out $50,000 and bought the rights to the show. Immediately, they put Oscar Brodney on the first draft, okay? And Oscar's pretty interesting. Oscar was born in Boston in 1907. He was a gag writer and a radio writer, mostly for Bob Hope. He would go to the film sets and write gags, extra gags into Bob's scripts. In fact, when he died in 1962, he was in London doing exactly that for Road to Hong Kong, or last road picture. I mean, he was with Universal forever, by the way. But he also wrote on RKO film, Eddie Cantor's last starring film, If You Knew Susie, with Joan Davis. And I think I've mentioned before that Eddie and Joan were an item for a while. Mm-hmm. Eddie strayed from Ida, and it was him and Joni, you know. Now, Joni, it's my turn to be on top. So that was terrible. And he also wrote on Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer, Boris Karloff. Yeah. And he was nominated for an Oscar for his work on the Glenn Miller story at Universal. And his very last, oh, he did a lot of TV, Francis the Talking Mule movies. Things were very, I don't know, how do you put it? He would work on Glenn Miller's story and then
yes.
go work on Francis the Talking Mule. What if he mixed them up? I think that would be much more interesting. We're going to take the plane and hopefully I won't get shot down.
I'd be very interested to see a mule trying to play the trombone. That would be very interesting.
I've seen it a few times, but only when I'm drinking. He passed away in 2008 at 100 years old, Mr. Brodney. His last film being Ghost Fever from 1987, a Sherman Hemsley star.
Yes.
It's half Mexican, half U.S. cast. I mean, it's just, yeah, sure.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I used to have a job where I would collect the film clips for SAG Awards. They would always be dedicated to something every year. And I was one of the people in charge of picking the clips, the film clips. And I also did that for the Television Hall of Fame. So like when William Frawley and Vivian Vance were inducted, I got to pick the clips, you know, which is an honor. It's wonderful. Yeah. But I had to do Sherman Hemsley, and he was nowhere to be found. He was doing like dinner theater in Arizona, and he died there alone, and nobody knew.
Wow.
he was doing dinner theater in Arizona, you know, and he died at the motel. Mm. Very weird. He had a very secret life from what I understand. Anyway, wow. That's all here and there. That's Oscar Brotny. And he's the main writer on this one. And he did a terrific job. He shared credit with John Grant, our friend John Grant, who added those burlesque routines into it. That really, like Jerry said, they show up like surprises, like nice surprises.
Yeah.
It's kind of an enhancement to an already good movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the other one working on the movie, you know what? I mixed up some people. I'm sorry. Oscar Brodny was not Bob Hope's guy. In fact, he's more interesting. Monty Bryce, who was a gag man for Bob Hope, he was the one who died in 1962 in London. And he was born in 1891 in New York City. So he was 71 when he died. But yeah, he also worked on Brown and Carney's Genius at Work.
Well, then.
One of my favorites. That's got Lionel Atwill and Bela Lugosi and my dear Anne Jeffries, my dear friend. So, he got to work with them. Okay, so that's Monty Bryce. And he worked with, also uncredited, Sid Fields, wrote on this film. Yeah, added. And I'm sure it was just the scene he was in because that was his specialty. You know, the fast talking, not listening, you know, stepping all over him. Mm-hmm. That's one of the funniest scenes, I think, that they put on film, that Abbott and Costello put on film. The interview with Sid Fields. But anyway, that was Monty Bryce. That's Sid Fields, who somebody wanted to know a little bit more about him. We did talk about him during In Society, if you want to go back and listen to that one. But here's a quickie. We'll give you a quickie. He was born 1898, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Sidney Hirsch Feldman. His parents were from Russia. He started out in amateur shows as a monologist. He teamed up in burlesque with a guy named Jack Greenman. They were signed by Minsky's and did very well, but they split in the mid-30s. He started writing for radio at that point for Rudy Valley and then for Eddie Cantor, became a character on the Eddie Cantor show named Mr. Guffey, and his job was basically doing what he does in this movie, only with Eddie Cantor. Mm-hmm. His first brush with Bud and Lou was in burlesque, of course, but they met up again for In Society, where a lot of his footage was cut. But he became like one of their main writers on radio, and then he became Mr. Fields on television, and was also a regular on the Jackie Gleason variety show, where he would do the same thing with Jackie Gleason, and that was in the 60s. He lived to 1975. He lived in Las Vegas, and he had a chatty little newspaper column that he wrote. I wish I had a collection of them. I'm sure they're very interesting. And he remembered a lot of stuff. He would go back and talk about stuff. So anyway, that would be interesting to find out if they're saved, if they're archived somewhere. That's Sid Fields. That's for whoever asked about him. And let's go back to Oscar Brodny. I feel like I owe him an apology. He was born in Boston in 1907. He's the one who lived to be 100. He died in 2008. He went to Boston University and Harvard Law School and became a lawyer. As a lawyer, he had a hobby of writing jokes and eventually drifted into radio, and then Universal scooped him up, and he became one of their main writers for years and years. And he was the one nominated for Glenn Miller's story. And he's the one who worked on If You Knew Susie with Eddie Cantor and Ghost Fever with Sherman Hemsley. Okay. So that catches us up with all the writers. Now, it's funny that Universal bought the rights to the play in 1946, but they didn't finish the script. They didn't work on it to its end until 2 years later. And that's when they added John Grant and Sid Fields and Monty Bryce. Okay. So, Abbott and Costello have this $50,000 movie coming up. Universal went to Broadway. It was a big hit. This was a big thing for them. And the boys don't want to do it. It's interesting because you all know Eddie Sherman, their manager, the guy who pretty much got them there. He really, really did. Mm-hmm. He deserves that credit. But Lou fired him before they started Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap. He felt like he upset his father enough to give him a heart attack. So Lou fired Eddie Sherman. So they are doing their own negotiations. Not a good idea. Lou is angry. They made a deal before Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Now they are on top of the world again. They are in the top three box office money makers. They have new power that they can go back with. And Lou, he asks for $25,000 more. And when they question him about it, he lets out that it's not the money. He wants better stuff. He's making a fortune for the studio. He wants Technicolor, like, you know, Martin and Lewis eventually got. He wants better casts. Okay. And this one, they got John Hubbard, Virginia Gray, and Luba Molina. He wanted Tony Martin, Lucille Ball, and Carmen Miranda.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have worked. It all would have worked just as well. So this is what he wanted. He felt like they've done everything already and they needed more to give to the audience, you know, rather than what they'd been giving them. So Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein was the game changer. And the way this worked out, boy, Lou went to Robert Arthur, the producer, and said, "We don't work past 4 o'clock. We don't care if we're in the middle of a setup. We don't care what's going on. We walk." And they're like, "No, you got to understand, the schedule is made up like between 9 and 6. And if we cut off those 2 hours, you know, we're going to be losing days. And that's going to come into thousands of dollars." And Lou's like, "Fine." He says, "I will do as good as I always do to make this a great picture. But we leave at 4 o'clock." And he doesn't want to hear anything else. Okay. Mm-hmm. Unless they come to him and say, "Okay, we're going to put another million in the budget and we're going to make this color and we're going to get some really name stars." Then they went to Bud, hoping that he would be on their side. Yeah. And he said, no, I don't care about the extra money. The script stinks. And we're leaving at 4 o'clock. So no help from Bud either.
Yeah.
So they hired an assistant director just to keep an eye on Bud and Lou to see if they're sabotaging the production. This is the whole thing between the executives and the stars. You know, it's like one doesn't appreciate the other. Yeah. The stars wouldn't have their fortunes or their fame without the studio, but the studio wouldn't have anything without the talent. Mm-hmm. So it's a catch 22 here, and you know, they're butting heads, and boy, do they need Eddie Sherman at this point. He was a negotiator, that no doubt about that. So interesting way to start a movie. Turns out that they stayed, you know, they went home probably 10 days before 4 o'clock, and sometimes they were sick. Bud had an injury, a shoulder injury, but this was the third or second most expensive movie Universal made that year. They went over, if you remember their last contract, they weren't supposed to go over $800,000. This was over $1 million in the budget. And boy, it looks it too. It's a really nice looking movie, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
Director of photography, the DP, Charles Van Enger, the shadows, and just absolutely gorgeous. So anyway, this is how they went into it. And, you know, everybody, you know, got out of it okay. They went over budget. They went over time a little bit. But the movie, they made twice what they spent on it at the box office. It was their third biggest moneymaker at Universal. Okay, so here we are. Mexican Hayride.
Yes.
And Jerry and I are both like weaving back and forth, you know, with this beautiful song. Maybe we can play some of that. Okay, so we've got that wonderful number bringing us in. And this is what I love about this movie. There's no big preamble. There's no, you know, background or anything like that. It's all presented to us in the very first scene. And then everything follows from there. Now, you've got the two detectives, okay? we've got Tom Powers, right? Mm-hmm. Who's the tall, thinner one. Born in Owensboro, Kentucky, one of my favorite towns, Owensboro. Great comedy town. Tom Powers, born in 1890 in Owensboro, died in 1955, went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts at the age of 16 years old. starred in Vitagraph Westerns during the silent days, made about 70 silent movies before talkies came in, but then he went to Broadway. He did a lot of things by Shaw, George Bernard Shaw, O'Neill. He did Strange Interlude by O'Neill. He took over for Orson Welles in Julius Caesar. Wow. This guy was an actor. This guy was a real actor. And he's most known, I would say, for Double Indemnity as the husband who gets killed.
Spoiler alert.
I like everyone doesn't know that.
Yeah.
But more interestingly is the other, his partner, who looks a little bit like Lou. It's Pat Costello. It's Lou's older brother by 3 years. Very close family. My buddy Bill Lewis, I know he's not listening to this, but Bill Lewis told me that the very first celebrity he met when he moved to Los Angeles was Pat Costello. Huh. And I didn't want to hear about anyone else. I just wanted to hear, really? What did he say? Did he say anything? Anyway, you never get much from people, you know, when they recount things that happened years ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, Pat Costello was born in 1903. Guess where?
Somewhere in New Jersey.
Yes, you're close.
Maybe Pat Patterson.
Patterson. Yeah. In fact, I think Pat is short for Patterson.
There you go, Patterson Costello. Yeah, it makes sense.
So yeah, Pat Costello, born in 1903, was Lou's stunt double for a few years before he got too old to do that. But you know, Universal advertised this as his first film. And that's not true. Mm. He worked at Monogram with the East Side Kids. He did a couple of those movies. He worked in a couple of the Bela Lugosi movies at Monogram. Mm. But more importantly, there was a Lee Tracy. Remember Lee Tracy? Fast-talking, you know, pre-code actor. Yeah, one of my faves.
Yeah.
He did a movie when he was, like, ousted from the big studios for peeing on a Mexican general. That's a whole other story. I'm serious.
Okay.
During the making of the film Viva Villa at MGM in 1934, Wallace Beery played Pancho Villa, mm-hmm. and Lee Tracy was hired to play the reporter who follows him around. Well, Lee Tracy was an alcoholic times 100. Mm. One morning while he was drinking, outside his balcony at his hotel, a Mexican general was supposedly making a speech, and he peed on his head. And he had to be sneaked out of Mexico because they were ready to put him in jail forever.
Wow.
And MGM had to step in. And once they did, he was fired. He never worked at a major studio until, like, his last movie, The Best Man, with Henry Fonda, where he steals the movie. But he made a movie called The Payoff at Monogram. And Pat Costello is the comedy relief. His hair is darkened. He wears a fedora turned up. And he looks just like Lou. So, you know, you see what they're doing. Yeah. It's called The Payoff. And I think you could probably see it on YouTube. So I found that very interesting. But anyway, he died in 1990 at the age of 87. He lived a much longer life than his little brother, unfortunately. I mean, fortunately, he did, but unfortunately.
Yeah.
So these two detectives are looking for a guy by the name of Joe Bascom. That's Lou Costello. And you have to suspend your belief for a second, your belief system. Mm-hmm. He's from Idaho. I'm going to let that sink in. Idaho.
Okay.
You know, that's what I think of, you know, Lou Costello, Idaho. And Bud also was coming from there. Here's the deal. It's a little complicated, but try and follow this. You know, try and follow it. I'm still talking like I'm 9 years old when I didn't understand it. Okay. Bud is Harry Lambert. He's a crook. He's a down and dirty crook. He's a villain. In Idaho, he gets Lou involved in a oil scheme. So they sold shares to this phony oil deal. And the feds find out about it, and Bud, who is Harry Lambert, he runs to Mexico, and Lou eventually has to go too. But his purpose is to find Harry Lambert, get the money that he stole from his friends, from Lou's friends, and go back and claim his innocence. So that's the plot. But they're looking for Joe Bascom. They're looking for him because, as far as the cops are concerned or the feds are concerned, Lou stole the money. and ran to Mexico. So they're looking for him. So they all meet up at the bull arena, at the bullfight arena, and it's so convoluted. Bud is now working a couple of different schemes in Mexico. Where did he find the time? He is managing a female bullfighter by the name of Montana. She's played by Virginia Gray, who was also in The Big Store in 1941, which I consider to be the Marx Brothers Abbott and Costello movie. So yeah, Virginia Gray is Montana. She looks very nice in her toreador. She looks toreadorable. I think that's a Popeye cartoon, toreadorable. But anyway, Bud is managing her, but she is Lou's ex-girlfriend from Idaho,
yep,
who also went to Mexico. Okay, Bud gets involved in this scheme. One of his partners, a guy named Gus Anderson, is a crook. And there's this thing, this program, this big thing going on in Mexico at the time called Amigo Americano. So whoever Montana throws her hat to will become the Amigo Americana, and basically an ambassador from America to Mexico. What they are planning on doing is using it to sell phony stocks to the public. I mean, they've got to trust the Amigo Americano, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like Trump, you got to trust him. sorry. In 2029, who? Trump, what? He's probably still going to be president. They plan on her throwing the hat to Gus Anderson, and then everybody's in business again. Okay, everybody's making money. But before she could throw the hat at Gus Anderson, she sees Lou, Joe Bascom, who she is still angry at, who she still thinks stole all that money, and she throws the hat at him, hits him in the head, he falls backwards, but he is now the Amigo Americano. And Bud is beside himself. Oh, my God, what are our plans? Blah, blah, blah. Gus Anderson is angry. He's like, what are you doing to me? Blah, blah, blah. Bud said, don't worry. We'll get the money. We'll get it to you. Everything will be fine. That's where we're set up. And there is a scene now where the two policemen, Tom Powers and Pat Costello, encounter Lou with the local police. And this dialogue ensues.
This guy adds up to Joe Bascom. Joe Bascom is short and dumpy. Like you? Like me. And he's got a roly-poly face. Like you? Like me. And he's got short, fat, stumpy legs. Like you? Yeah, like me! Officer, arrest that man!
I thought it was so clever to use Pat. You know? Yeah. He's terrible, but, you know, it's great that to see him. That's a great bit. And it's fun to watch the two brothers working together. They were very close, the two of them. Very, very close. As I was saying to Jerry earlier, Pat's not exactly an actor. He's yeah. he's got that flat New Jersey accent, you know, and delivery. It's just doesn't work. Better taking falls for his brother.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that's the deal. Lou tells them his name is Humphrey Fish. They don't have a picture of Joe Bascom. They have to send away for it. It's going to take some time. You know, this is before cell phones and fax machines. So they have to wait for the picture. So in the meantime, Lou is Humphrey Fish and Bud takes over. Yes, I know this man. I've known him for years. What's his name? Humphrey Fish. Humphrey Fish, yes. So Bud's great when he's put in those positions and he has to talk his way out. He's great. So Lou does not want to lose sight of Bud because Bud is the crook and he wants to make sure he gets the money. Bud doesn't want to get Lou out of his sights because he's now the Amigo Americano and is very important in selling the phony stocks. That's as much as Bud is involved in this film. Everything else is Lou. It's amazing. It's just a Lou Costello movie. Okay, so Luba Molina, who plays Dagmar, is Bud's partner in crime. And she's played by the lovely Luba Molina. Now, Jerry.
Yes.
Now, when you were watching this, and I know this is one of the movies I saw most when I was a kid. This was always on, you know, and maybe three times a year. And so I'm very familiar with it. I did not realize that Luba Molina was not Mexican or Latina.
And, you know, until I read your chapter on this movie in your book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, I was in that same camp.
Right?
She just is. I mean, how could you argue that?
She's like a Mexican Spitfire, you know? Yeah, yeah. My little fish. She's from St. Petersburg, Russia. Ah. Her father was, big in the Moscow Art Theater. She started as a child with the Moscow Art Theater and also as a dancer. Her father's name was Vitaly Malina, and she appeared with Pavlova's children's dance troupe when she was five. Mm. Wow. Yeah. And then she grew up, and via Shanghai, London, Paris, she landed here in the United States in the late 1930s. She sang in nightclubs, worked for Mike Todd on Broadway in a show called Priorities of 1942 with another Paterson, New Jersey native, Burt Wheeler. And she also appeared with Burt in Las Vegas. She made some Soundies, the jukebox films. I got to look those up. I'll bet she's great. And then later she married a prominent New York attorney, worked sporadically on stage and television until 1960, retired and died in New York in 1982. But Russian, I was blown away.
Never would have guessed it.
No. But she is, okay, I have a lot to talk about with her because apparently she did not like making this movie. She is the only cast member from the original Broadway show to be brought in to the movie. Okay. So let me fill you in on a few things here from my own personal standpoint. People who originate parts on stage often resent, number one, either Hollywood replacing you with a name, I'm holding up my quotation marks, or you look around and you realize you're not dealing with Bobby Clark, who you were friends with, or you're not dealing with, this person over here who you did it for 2 years with, So Luba had her own thing going on. And when you watch my favorite scene in the movie, her song and how Lou reacts to it, they're stepping all over each other. There's very little respect, I see, personally. Mm-hmm. She'll be doing a bit, and Lou will step on it. We'll step on the punchline. And the punchlines aren't jokes. They're sounds and things she's doing. And she does it to him as well. So I see two comedians butting heads. Mm. And this was for the first time, as I watched it last night, knowing how she felt about making the movie. Yeah. So it made sense to me that she was... being a little bit of a brat, and so was he. But yeah, Lou was on, I think he needed Eddie Sherman, and he was afraid to admit it, and he had to deal with all that went with that. Yeah. Okay, so Luba is Bud's partner. They have to get the money. And one of my favorite scenes is coming up. By the way, the samba, Lou's character, Joe Bascom, did the samba for 68 hours straight. And won a contest. That's how he won the money to get to Mexico. And every time a samba is played, he starts dancing. He can't control it. And it may be the funniest thing in the movie. Is every time he stops playing the samba. The funny thing is, the samba is not a Mexican dance. It's Brazilian. But this was not in the original script. This was added on set. Ah. It's not in the Broadway show. It's not in the script. Yeah. Somebody said, it'd be funny if so-and-so, happened. So how cool is that? Huh. This is where Buster Keaton would get mad. Boy, they didn't care what they did and blah, blah, blah. But that's because they were spontaneous. They would improvise, just a different way of working. Now, Montana, Virginia Gray, mm-hmm. Very beautiful lady. She was born in 1917 in Edendale, California, a town that doesn't exist anymore.
Wow.
It's where the original Max Sennett studios were, but everything was rezoned. Oh. So she possibly never born. So Virginia Gray was born in a vacuum in 1917. Her father was a director of silent films. But here's the interesting thing. When she was a child, she appeared in the silent film Uncle Tom's Cabin as Little Eva. And in the movie, Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops, as the movie begins, Lou is in a movie theater watching that movie.
Yes.
Isn't that cool? I love things like that. So Virginia Gray is actually in two Abbott and Costello movies. But only got paid for one. Okay. So Virginia Gray, 1917. She was signed by MGM in the late 1930s and played mostly leads in B-movies and things like The Big Store with the Marx Brothers. But mm-hmm. she was mostly, to movie buffs, she was Clark Gable's girl on the side. What do you call her? She was always there for Clark Gable, and they had an affair for years and years until he kicked off in 1960. Gable, he used to go home and drink a quart of alcohol every night and drink himself into oblivion.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. When you talk about alcoholics of old Hollywood, his name seldom comes up, but he was one of the biggest.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the movie. So these are the guys that have to get the money from Lou after he sells the phony stocks for them. Lou is taking his job very seriously as the Amigo Americano. He's given a sales force to sell his phony stocks, and they are all beautiful women, sales force. And he keeps Bud tied up in the closet because he has to keep an eye on Bud. So after he unties Bud is like, you know, we've got to continue. You're Humphrey Fish. You got to remember, you're Humphrey Fish. You're not Joe Bascom. So he sees Joe Bascom, JB, initials on Lou's coat. So he makes him take his coat off. And of course, in true Bud Abbott fashion, you know, you'd end up in traction, you know, the way he handles you, you know. So he rips off his coat. He sees it on his shirt. He rips off his shirt. He sees it on his handkerchief. He tears his handkerchief to him. This is pure burlesque. It's just great. Mm-hmm. This is John Brandt, you know. And then eventually, of course, he sees it on his pants and he rips his pants off. And he's wearing those pantaloons underneath, right?
Yeah,
is that what you would call those?
Yeah.
They're like pantaloons. And then, of course, you know, I love when Lou calls him and says, you know, I may be wrong, but you might want to check my collar. He looks, and sure enough, there it is, and he rips his shirt off. But the thing that got me when I was a kid during this scene, not only did I find it very funny, but it's the trick Lou does with the apple. He's eating an apple, and he does this thing where he flips it, and he catches it, you know, behind him. And I learned how to do it. I'd be in the backyard with a tennis ball, and I learned how to do it. Anyway, he was very agile that way. So Bud leaves, and who comes in to interview Lou? Sid Fields. Now, this is one of the funniest scenes in the movie, and this is what Sid Fields did better than anybody else. And if we don't play this, we're definitely off the mark.
Mr. Fish, on behalf of the Amalgamated Press, I'd like to ask you a few questions. How do you feel about this tremendous responsibility that's been vested in you in making you the Amigo Americano?
Well,
you're pretty sure of yourself, aren't you? You characters are all alike. Would you say the inter-American relationship, as exemplified by your lackadaisical efforts to promote goodwill, could possibly accomplish anything?
Well,
You're exaggerating. You sound like an egotist. Why do you attempt to use polysyllabic conversation when your intelligence quotient is obviously minus nil? Why don't you just stick to words of one syllable? You know what a syllable is?
Yeah.
What's a syllable?
A syllable.
Are you sure you know what it is?
Yeah.
Give me your definition of a syllable. Go ahead, what's a syllable? Take it easy, don't get excited. Just one word at a time. You're sure you know what it is? What's a syllable? Go ahead, don't get excited.
Yeah, what is
it? I want you to tell the girls so the girls know that you're talking to me now. What's a syllable? Don't rush yourself. I want the girls to know that you're a very smart man and intelligent individual. Now don't turn your back. What's a syllable exactly?
A syllable.
You're sure that you know what a syllable is? Go on, take it easy now. Now, give me a simple explanation. If you give it to me, it's bound to be simple. That's the idea now. We're getting somewhere. Exactly what is a syllable? You don't mind if I get a word in here, do you?
No, you go ahead. I'm getting hoarse now.
I'll give you the help. Look, a syllable is a sound.
Yeah.
Now, how is the sound of a syllable formed?
It's formed
by letters of the alphabet placed in juxtaposition one to the other.
Mm-hmm. See what I mean?
No. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Now, how many letters would you say there are in the alphabet?
Well, there's about...
Not about. There's a definite number.
New rules, huh?
No. There's always been a definite number of syllables and letters in the alphabet. Now, are they all alike?
No. Well, I got that one in.
Of course. Now, there are two types of letters, consonants and vowels. Can you name the consonants?
Yes, sir. There's North America, South America, and Paterson, New Jersey.
No. The consonants are 21 in number. There are 21 consonants and 5 vowels. Now, 21 and 5?
28.
No, 26.
I was close.
All right. Now, you take the consonants and vowels and put them together. What do you form? Syllables. Syllables form words. Words form sentences. And then people talk or they do what you've been doing.
And what have I been doing?
You've been making a fool of yourself.
Now, look.
You're trying to attack me, eh? After I treat you like a gentleman, you get antagonistic and belligerent, I dare you to hit me once more. Using both of your hands on me, huh? You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Trying to pull a knife or something. I'm surprised. Let me give you a little piece of advice before I leave. Remember, in the future, when a reporter comes in and asks you for an interview, don't talk so much.
I have to say that Lou is as funny as Sid Fields in this sketch. The things he interjects with are so funny. You know, how many letters in the alphabet? 28? 26. I was close. Great stuff. Great stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, so Sid gets to do his specialty, and it's a highlight of the film. Definitely a highlight of the film. Okay, so let's jump ahead. This is all going on. How do they sell the stocks? Lou has to make a speech as the Amigo Americano to a lot of influential money people. And what they do is Luba Molina and Bud, Harry Lambert and Dagmar, switch the speech around so it's Lou selling their phony stocks. So how does Lou do this? You know, I think, is it Luba Molina who says, you have to deliver this speech? And he goes, well, that can't be hard. I used to deliver newspapers. They were much heavier than this piece of paper. Oh, by the way, I love when the audience at the bullring is yelling, ole, ole. And Lou says, who's this Swedish guy, ole? What are they saying? Anyway, so yeah, where was I? So they need an enunciation teacher, an elocution teacher, mm-hmm. to teach him how to make this speech and speak clearly and professionally. And who do they hire? My old pal, Fritz Feld. Ow. And Fritz is at his best here. He is at his best. He is hilarious. How do you do? Here's my cane, my hat, my gloves. And he turns around and then sees, what are you doing with my cane and my hat and my gloves? And he takes them back. And of course, his work with Lou is just exemplary. It is just hilarious. It's him teaching Lou how to speak properly. And of course, none of it is valid. And he, you know, he couldn't care less. He's there to flirt with Luba Molina.
Yep.
But this is one of Fritz Feld's funniest scenes ever filmed by this hilarious man. Mm-hmm. And Lou, of course, as he's going to pull the cork out of the wine, Fritz Feld is behind him and gives him the, and Lou is like looking at us, I didn't pull the cork. How did this, you know, and when he finally finds out what it is, he tries it himself and of course knocks himself out. One of the funniest scenes in the movie, just hilarious.
Yeah.
So Lou makes the speech in front of those people, and that was pretty funny as well. And everybody wants a piece of this. They all trust the Amigo Americano, including Joe Kirk, Lou's brother-in-law. He's there too. He wants a piece of the action. You know, it's not enough that he's married to Lou's sister. So you marry my sister, hey. So everything's working. Everything's going according to plan. They cash out the wazoo because everyone wants a piece of this. Lou has the cash and he hides it because he doesn't want Harry Lambert, Bud, to get it. He doesn't trust Bud. So Bud tells Luba Molina to seduce Lou and find out where the money is. And this is the beginning of my favorite scene in the whole movie. This song, number one, it will stay with you forever. The three musicians, the Flores brothers, are just fantastic. They were also in Rio Rita, by the way. They were part of that ensemble. But Luba Molina does a song here called Is It Yes or Is It No? And I think we need to play some of it here.
Is it yes or is it no?
Do you love
me? Do you hate me? Should I stay or should I go?
Stop.
But my life won't be better.
Stop the music.
How do we go?
Stop.
Is it
please
yes?
Stop. Please stop the samba. Please don't let him play the samba.
Cause my life won't depend. How the wind will blow.
Don't!
Is it yes? Or is it no?
Fellas, please. Quiet, will you, fellas? No more shouting. Please, fellas, quiet. Please.
Oh, I've got
and this is wonderful because Lou is reacting to everything. And his reactions are very, very funny. He throws a rose down to her from his balcony and it comes back like a yo-yo back into his hand. She's, while she's like talking to him. She's ripping the apartment apart, looking for the money the entire time. But what I was referring to before, if you watch this scene, watch the two of them. The timing of the jokes is just a little off. It looks like they're purposely, and especially Lou, it looks like he's purposely cutting off her punchlines. There's the whole thing where she does the Tarzan round. She hits that really high note. Mm-hmm. He kind of does something over it, you know, and it's a little uncomfortable. But like I was saying, I think Luba felt she was a little too good for this and took it out on the production. So anyway, that scene is just gorgeous. And she finds out where Lou hid the money. She steals the money, but not before Lou asks for a kiss. And Lou is wearing spurs, metal spurs on the back of his boots. And when he kisses her, the spur goes into, goes into the plug where you would plug in your plugs. What do you call that?
A socket.
Yeah, a socket. Okay. So anyway, the spur goes into the socket just as they're kissing. And of course, sparks happen and she is over the moon. Mm-hmm. I have never been kissed like that before by any man. But that's important. She's not just throwing that away. That's important for later. So she's got the money. The FBI and the guy in charge of Amigo Americano, the John Hubbard character, he's the straight guy who supposedly is having an affair with Virginia Gray. And again, it's not developed, so we don't know anything about it. Yeah. But anyway, he's the straight arrow, and he finds out what Harry Lambert and Joe Bascom are up to, and he comes to arrest them. And people are yelling for Lou, you know, the Amigo Americano, to step out onto his balcony and say a few words. So they let him do that, and he disappears. He runs away. Okay. The feds have Bud. And this is another one of my favorite scenes. There are so many good scenes in this movie, folks. I'm not kidding. Give it a chance. It's so good. So Bud is in the backseat. He's handcuffed, and Pat Costello is driving the car. And Tom Powers is in the back with Bud. They get a flat tire. It just so happens, and this is Bobby Clark did this in the Broadway show. It just so happens that Lou is dressed as an old Mexican woman pushing a tamale cart down this road in Calabasas, California, where I used to teach. It's a beautiful area. But it just so happens that they have the flat tire, and Lou happens to be there pushing this heavy cart dressed as a woman. The cart isn't dressed like a woman, Lou is. Sometimes Lou is a la carte. He enjoys that. But anyway, so he's pushing the thing, and so they stop to fix the tire, and they suggest, you know, hey, we're hungry. Let's get some lunch. So they send Bud over to make the order, and he realizes that it's Lou, and they get a plan. They're going to poison the cops. So they're going to put every hot thing they have into these tortillas and roll them up and give them to the cops to make them ill. It doesn't work out. They want Bud to take the first bite because they don't trust them. So they give it to Bud. He's holding it. Remember, he's got handcuffs on. When the hot stuff starts dripping onto the chain that holds the handcuffs together, it melts the metal and his hands are free. I mean, the cops don't know this because he goes right back again, but he sees that his hands are free. So in the meantime, they tell Lou, no, we don't want this. We don't want anything so hot. So he takes out this big wad of dough and he starts punching it. He's supposed to be kneading it, you know, like a nice Mexican woman. And it's so funny. He makes this long, long, long rope-like dough. You know, it'd be the longest French bread in the world. And he starts twirling it over his head. And of course, he connects it with the two cops who their heads bashed together. They're getting wet from the dough thrown at their heads. And then Bud, being Bud in this movie, being the villain, he runs for their car, doesn't wait for Lou, and just takes off, leaving Lou to run after the car as he throws the tortillas with the hot stuff and they explode like grenades. But Bud leaves them there, yep. Stranded in Calabasas, which leads to another great scene. This is just, I'm sorry, it's just, there's one yeah. after another. Lou shows up as the musician at the Bull Arena, and he's got this mustache and these heavy eyebrows and glasses, and he's got the big serape and the sombrero. And Chris Penn Martin, the great Mexican comedian, he's leading his little orchestra, you know, and Lou has a trombone. I don't know where he got it, but he shows up with a trombone and he tries to join the band and he's terrible. So the guy takes the trombone, you know, Lou, of course it breaks and Lou blows into the wrong parts and all this. But he says, "You're a terrible trombone player. Here, you tried the piccolo." So he takes the piccolo and he's worse with the piccolo. And of course he's thrown out of the orchestra. After being admonished by Chris Penn Martin, and he goes to go into the Bull Arena, but he bumps into another Mexican fellow by the name of El Butto Abatado. this is Bud dressed as a Mexican. So the two of them run into each other and they try to communicate using those American to a Mexican books, you know,
yeah.
the language books. And Bud is very funny in this. He goes, you know, he's going for to each page to get one word at a time, you know. And Lou then takes out his book and he has makes a great, you know, effort in opening up the right page, getting to it, finding it, you know, going down and then just saying, "See." And that's their communication. But anyway, they realize that who they are, and it becomes a big thing. You know, where's the money? Who's got the money? Blah, blah, blah. Lou tells them that Dagmar has it. It's gone, you know. And so it turns out that Dagmar, after that kiss, has fallen for Lou. Mm-hmm. She has never been kissed that way before. So she, not trusting Bud, kept the money for Lou, put it in this hat she had, and she was holding it for him. Lou, at this point, has to fight the bull. It turns out that, you know, he has to be there. He runs into the wrong place. The bull follows him out. And the whole time I'm watching it, I'm thinking of my 8mm version of "No Bulls, Please." You know, I don't know what kind of Einstein came up with that. Those I had "No Bulls, Please." I had "No Indians, Please."
Yep. Yep.
From Ride 'Em Cowboy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, "Hey, Murray, what can we call this? How about the "No Salami, Please"? Okay, let's go. We'll do that one. You know, the Castle Film people.
Yep.
This was the year, actually, that Bud and Lou retained the rights to those 8 and 16 millimeter films.
Oh.
Made a fortune. Universal tried to get away with it. Mm. And when Bud and Lou found out about it, Universal buckled and said, yeah, it's yours. You can have it, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a really good bullfight segment.
Yes.
And I write in the book that although I'm an animal rights activist and I find bullfighting to be abhorrent, in fact, my main agent in Hollywood during my glory years was a guy by the name of David Moss. And David's uncle was, what the hell was his name? Samuel. He started out as an editor at MGM and produced Ben-Hur later on. Sam Zimblist was his uncle. But David Moss was one of two famous bullfighters, American bullfighters in Spain. I believe the other one was Bud Bedeker, the director. But yeah, he was a bullfighter. And I used to feel really icky about that. You know, here's a guy who's got pictures of killing bulls on his wall. And, you know, I'm dead set against it. So eventually I had to fire him. But anyway, so this one is good. I love Kid from Spain is my favorite Eddie Cantor movie. Mm-hmm. And that's a bullfight movie. Yep. The Bullfighters, Laurel and Hardy, is their best 20th Century Fox film. You know, their last American film. And there was another one. I can't remember. The Three Stooges.
Yes.
Sappy Bullfighters, which was their last with Joe Besser. But the original, What's the Matador, with Curly. So those are, I love bullfighter comedies. I don't know why. But this one stands out. And of course, they play the samba at one point. And not only does Lou do the dance, but the bull actually does the dance. And at one point, his eyes cross, the bull's eyes cross when Lou tries to hypnotize him and grab the hat. She throws the hat with the money, you know, hoping that Lou will get it, but it ends up on the horn of the bull.
Yes.
Of course, Lou, in pure Lou speak, you know, look, the hat, it's over there on the big thing that's coming out of the thing. You mean the horn? Oh, boy. Anyway, so, okay. Lou gets butt in the butt, and he flies up to audience level, and he sees John Hubbard and says, here's the money. Here, we're innocent. Boom, he throws it. John Hubbard gets the money back, and the final scene is everybody getting exonerated. With the return of the money, that means Joe Bascom can go back to being Joe Bascom. He's innocent. And Dagmar and Harry Lambert, Bud, they are also forgiven because the money has been returned. And didn't happen that way in the play. But the final thing is they're in a cart, a mule-drawn cart, and Bud is driving. And he has a little portable radio next to him. I think it was the one they won in Who Done It. It plays anywhere. So he turns it on, and what plays? The samba. And Lou is just about to go in for the kiss, and he has to dance away because he can't help it. And we fade out. The end. Excellent Abbott and Costello. Yes. Excellent. Yes. I can't recommend it highly enough. So I hope we did justice to it. Your thoughts, Jerry? You've been kind of quiet about this film. This was their holiday offering for 1948, by the way. It opened December 27th.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. No, I was kind of quiet because, you know, you were basically saying all the good stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
You're editing, so take me out and put you in, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
I have to record an introduction. Today, welcome to Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. I'm Jerry I'm Nick Santa Maria, and I have the pleasure of introducing to all of you my partner and friend, a guy who really has made theatrical history by doing a lot of theatrical history. Here he is, Jerry Schneidman. You know what? We'll continue with our regular roles.
I think that would be best. Yeah. Let's just keep it that way.
I think so.
Yes, I'm in total agreement with you. It's an excellent film. And as you mentioned earlier, and we had talked about, you know, before recording here today as well, that may be one of the difficulties that Abbott and Costello fans have with it. It's an excellent film and not a typical Abbott and Costello film.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. This is where they're becoming more situational. Mm-hmm. They're following the trends of post-war tastes, which were eschewing. I love that word.
Yes.
That kind of mindless, you know, we're going to do this, and then we're going to do a song, and then we're going to do this. And now they were actual real scripts and real movies. And not for the worse, you know?
And I also think this may be true. Correct me if I'm wrong. I would like your opinion on this as well. This may be more true for comedians because comedy changes over the decades.
Yes.
And so you and I both are Marx Brothers fans. You know, what they did in the 20s, late 20s, early 30s was very funny, very good for the time period. As the 40s came along, they had to change, they had to adapt. Same thing with Bud and Lou here. You know, when they started making films, it was this style, and now we're moving on from that. But I think that affects comedy more so than straight drama.
Because comedy is so subjective, is such a personal thing,
mm-hmm.
things that make you laugh. Right?
Yeah.
Something that makes you laugh hysterically, I might look at you like, what? Huh? What are you talking about? It's so subjective. It's such a delicate art form. And you're absolutely right. Things changed post-war. Just as things changed post-code. Pre-code was, mm-hmm. was one thing. That's where the Marx Brothers, you know, flourished.
Yeah.
And then the code, Wheeler and Woolsey too, the code took away their teeth.
Yeah.
So Wheeler and Woolsey ended up making films for children, mostly. You know, everybody was affected by it, but especially Mae West. Mae West, her whole show was about being naughty. And when you take that away, you know, you've got a middle-aged heavyset broad. Boy, I'm going to hear about that. But anyway, but you're absolutely right. Things changed. Things became more situational. Things became, and I hate to say this, but things became more formulaic as it became more and more of a factory. But interesting times when this film was made, 1948. This is the time that the Supreme Court took away their movie theaters. Like Paramount had thousands of theaters across the country. So you can guarantee their movies were going to make a certain amount of money. But it was, those were monopolies, and they had to give them up. So Universal was amenable to Abbott and Costello's demands at this point. They listened. And when, of course, when Eddie Sherman came back, things got back to normal. But they were really looking forward to their next film, Africa Screams. It was another one of their independent films, which means they made more money. They had more freedom to play. In fact, this movie is so loose, it looks like outtakes from the TV show. I hate to say, it's not my favorite. It's in fact, next week, we are going to be, next week, the next episode is going to be about Africa Screams, and I don't know how Jerry feels about it, but it's one of my least favorite Abbott and Costello films.
And funny you should have mentioned earlier in this particular episode, bringing up Shemp Howard. Speaking of Africa Screams, yes. And Joe Besser, we mentioned in this episode, and we'll talk about them next time as well.
Yes, yes, and definitely, definitely have to put some attention on that. Joe came off better than Shemp. I think Shemp was very funny, but he didn't have much to do.
No.
You know? And he was still a stooge at this point. He was a stooge.
Oh, well, yeah. I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah.
This is 49. He started with the Stooges in 46.
Yeah.
So anyway, interesting, interesting setup here. So join us for the next one. And that's, again, it's Africa Screams. Lou also put together a 10,000 Kids and a Cop. A two-reel movie starring William Bendix, his best buddy in Hollywood. And it's all about the Lou Costello Jr. Youth Foundation. And it's terrific. We'll talk about that next week as well. Jerry, I can't say it enough. This is the highlight of my week and my 2 weeks. And it's always such a pleasure to break bread with you. Wait, are we breaking bread?
I broke something. I don't know what it was, but you know, it might have been bread.
That's about crystal meth, isn't it? Breaking bread?
Yeah, let's not go there.
I think so.
And you always say it first, but I agree wholeheartedly. I look forward to this every 2 weeks, getting together with you. And I just hope and pray that our listeners feel the same way.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. I'm getting emails from Audio Boom, which is the service I pay for in order to have access to all the platforms. Uh-huh. And they're telling me that they're trying to advise me about YouTube, saying, you know, there's no reason for you to do that for free. You know, people are going there and they're not subscribing to this or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. I'm not tech savvy. And especially since we don't have a part two for Abbott and Costello Friends. I think that, you know, the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah.
But let's say our goodbyes. And thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We really appreciate your listening. And again, if you are listening on YouTube, it is all important that not only you subscribe, hit the subscribe button, but also like, hit the thumbs up if you like us. Okay? Because we really, that's what this is all about. We're trying to get this started and we'd like it to become a thing, you know, much like the other podcasts out there. Okay, kids, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time with Africa Screams.
You think that a short time ago that was just a hunk of silver ore?
Silver ore what?
Silver.
Silver ore.
Silver ore what?
Silver ore.
Well, it's got to be silver ore something. Right. It can't be silver ore nothing.
It's possibly been lying in the ground thousands and thousands of years. You see, they dig it up and then they smell it.
That's been in the ground for thousands of years? No wonder it smells. I wouldn't dig it up. I'd dig it deeper. Down, down as far as you could get your... Put a pole and stick it down in the dirt and cover it over dirt.
What he's trying to tell you is that the ore is smelted.
What kind of English is that?
Well, smelted means smelted by a smelter. When a smelter melts, it smells. Now, does that penetrate?
I'm getting a whiff of it.
Then after it's smelted down, It's made into these beautiful ornaments by a smith.
By a smith?
Mm-hmm.
Well, couldn't Jones make it?
Oh, sure, but he'd still be a smith.
How can a Jones be a smith? A Jones is a Jones.
He's got to be a smith in order to make these.
Jones don't have to be a smith.
Definitely.
Why should Jones change his name just to make these things?
Don't change his name. And you want to go to school, stupid?
Yes, sir, and I come out the same way.
That's what I thought.
I used to go to school.
Now, look. You take a shovel, you go down into the mine. You locate the mother lode. Then you strike the vein.
Just a minute.
And it's...
Don't go no further.
What?
I've had enough of you.
What do you mean?
Now listen to you. I didn't mind it when you told me that a guy had to change his name from Jones to Smith to make this kind of stuff.
Who?
And I didn't mind it when you said to me that it was silver ore and you refused to finish the sentence. And that goes for you, too.
Stop here.
I didn't mind any of that kind of stuff.
Take it easy.
But when you say to me that I have to go into a mine with a shovel and hit my mother in the vein while she's carrying a load, that is going too far.